when we finally hit the road, and I mean, we would have been, if it wasn't for our management, we would have been, you know, one of those bands that just sort of disappeared, you know, from the 60s into the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was Frank Zappa sold his label, Straight Records, to Warner Brothers Records. And there were 10 acts on the label, and one of the acts was, you know, a straighter kind of an act, but from Tucson, Arizona, called the Stone Ponies.
Mm-hmm.
Their lead singer happened to be Linda Ronstadt, and then there was this folk guy that was also that Frank was hooked up with called James Taylor. So, and Alice Cooper and Wildman Fisher and the GTOs and the BTOs and a couple of other Captain Beefheart, those were all on the label. But Warner Brothers saw something in Linda Ronstadt and James Taylor, so they bought the whole catalog, the whole 10 bands, they bought for $50,000.
Wow.
Okay. Unbeknownst to them, I mean, they were going to release everybody except for James Taylor and Linda Ronstadt, but unknown to them, our management was not about to let that happen. We had a legal contract with Warner Brothers Records, and they talked them into a 4-song demo. And because, you know, by that, I think we sold 12,000 copies of Pretty's for You, and then we sold like 4,000 of Easy Action. So,
why do you think Easy Action didn't sell as well as Pretty's for You? Was it a distribution thing?
I have no idea. You know, I just don't know.
Did you guys tour a lot for that record?
Yeah, yeah. As a matter of fact,
more shows with Frank?
Not really, because I think we may have done a few just if we cross our paths on the circuit, because we had by that time lived in Michigan, and so now working out of Michigan, and Frank was in Los Angeles. I mean, it just didn't. You know, just
so you guys made it out to Michigan after Easy Action?
Yeah.
And what prompted the move out there besides just the...
Well, that's a great question, Joe. It's the reason we went out there is because while we were touring after Pretty's for You, and the first place in the country that actually sort of got what we were doing, because Los Angeles didn't get what we were doing, San Francisco didn't get what we were doing. We could always go to Phoenix and make some money. But when we started playing in the Midwest, because they had the MC5 and they had the Stooges, and all of a sudden, Alice Cooper comes and is as outrageous on stage as they are with the music and the you know, the powerful music and everything. But all of a sudden, they're just, you know, it's like totally out of the groove of what's going on there. It's a whole, you know, because it's all black leather in Detroit, you know.
Right.
And all of a sudden, this is all glam and Hollywood and props and theatrics and makeup, and I mean, it's the same thing. It's the same power that these bands had, but all of a sudden, it was like another, you know, it was like another level.
Right.
So the bottom line, what I'm trying to explain here, is that we found an audience in the Midwest, which is amazing because that's where, you know, that's where Glenn and I were from, and we get back there, and that was the first part of the whole wide world that really took Alice Cooper in.
Okay. So how long were you out there before you started recording Love It to Death?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not really quite sure, but I know that we lived at the house in Pontiac, probably, and we probably got the house there because we got the deal with Warner Brothers, and the deal with Warner Brothers was, like I said, so it may not even, you know, maybe 3, 4, 5, 6 months.
So the deal with Warner Brothers initially was just for a 4-song demo?
Yeah.
And then what happened from there?
Well, the story is the 4-song demo, because again, we would have lived or died by that demo.
Right.
And Michael was writing some songs. We were all writing music. And at that time, one of the most popular bands that kept having hit after hit after hit was right out of Canada, the Guess Who.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that Jack Richardson and his company Nimbus 9 was producing these records. So we talked about it. And we told Shep, he said, go to Canada and see if we can get these guys to produce our next album. We didn't know a title or anything at that time. Go, you know, produce the next album. Well, you know, a long story pretty quickly is that that Shep Gordon and Joe Greenberg were partner management at the time, went to Toronto, and every day they kept going to Nimbus 9 and kept bugging Jack Richardson to look at this band, not sign it, but I mean, just look at it. Just go see them live, see them live, see them live. And he said, no. Well, then all of a sudden, they have this new kid that they just signed as a producer. He's like 18 years old, and his name's Bob Ezrin. And Jack says, I know what I'll do, because I've talked to Bob about this story. I've talked to Bob recently about it. He said, we were going to play at Max's Kansas City in New York. Obviously, this is before, this is like 60, I don't know, probably 71. And, because I'm trying to, I think, Killer came out late 71, right?
Yeah.
Or, yeah, 71, yeah. So this is probably, this is even may have been early 70s. Late 70, because we recorded Love It to Death and Killer both the same year. In 1970, and so we got our management got Bob Ezrin to come down there, and Jack Richardson, he's going to go down there and see these guys. What, makeup, props? They wear women's clothes. Go on stage. He said he's going to come back here scared to death. He said this band is going to, because his background is all classical. He's a very straight guy. And he just got out of, you know, college or high school or whatever, and he's, you know, he was a genius at what he was doing, but he said, we were going to scare him to death. Well, Bob came down and saw us and flipped out, goes back to Toronto and said, this is the wave of the future. You've got to sign these guys. We've got to work with them. We have to produce their record. And so, you know, the total 180 of what Jack Richardson thought was going to happen. So Warner Brothers said, okay, we'll do the four songs. And Jack Richardson, Nimbus 9, with Bob Ezrin would produce it. And one of the four songs was I'm 18. So we put the demo together. They heard it.
What were the other three songs?
You know what? I don't remember. All
okay.
I know is that 18 was the one that got the, which we figured would probably be the single.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not very many songs on the album, and I guarantee it wasn't Black Juju.
Okay.
So... So it could have been like, you know, Long Way to Go. It probably wasn't Second Coming or Sunrise. So it was probably like, you know, Long Way to Go, Caught in a Dream, maybe even Hallowed Would Be My Name.
Dwight Fry, maybe? Or
Could have been, but I think those songs were really developed more after we had the deal.
Okay. Speaking of Black Juju, I read somewhere that was the only song you recorded live in the studio for that album?
That's true. That was probably the only, after Pretty's Few, it's the only song we ever recorded live. And I think, because all the instruments were live, usually we would be lucky to get the drums and the bass together. And then from then on, you just build the song.
Right.
But that was a live recording because we wanted to get the fire from our live performance of that song.
Was that a hard transition to make from recording the first couple albums, kind of live in the studio to recording things individually and building from there?
Not really, because we recorded everything, you know, as a band. And when you record with a band, it makes a lot of difference.
Right.
So, you know, all you do is just to, you know, I mean, everything's fine, everything, but you know, we just want to make it the best, you know, when you have the ability to you know, re-record the rhythm track or fix something in the bass track, you know, why not do it?
Sure.
And of course we would do that. But the drum track is the only thing that, you know, you've got to get from the beginning to the end most every time.
Right.
And so yeah, that was the only song that we did. And the transition, like I said, we were so ready for all this stuff. I mean, we wanted to do this one, you know, 2 weeks after I joined the band. So by the time... this came around, and you know, Bob came down from Toronto down to Pontiac, Michigan, to our house, and we worked all the songs out, and then Warner Brothers loved 18, and they said, yeah, let's do an album, and you know, then we did the album, and bang, it goes right up the charts, and I think it hit number one in Cleveland, as a matter of fact, before it hit number one anywhere. I just read that somewhere that I'm 18 hit number one in Cleveland. It was the first town in the country to go number one.
Wow.
And I didn't realize that. I mean, it wasn't long after that Detroit and some of the other Midwest cities that followed suit. But Cleveland was the very first. You know, the radio stations in Cleveland were the very first ones to make it go number one. So again, I mean, I'm just so indebted to the fans in that part of the country, because you know, it was, I don't know, it's just like, you know, we hit a nerve, and everybody responded to it, and the timing was perfect for us, too.
So the album came out, 18 was released as a single, shot to number one, various places around the country.
Yeah.
What was it like going from, you know, a struggling band, basically, you know, working out songs in a barn, to all of a sudden, basically overnight, becoming a number one selling artist?
Well, you can now buy a six-pack of beer instead of just one beer at a time. That was probably the first major thing that I noticed.
Uh-huh.
But no, it was the crowds. It was, you know, you know, we had hardcore fans that, you know, knew the music, but now any place we would go, people knew the music. That's the biggest difference.